Here we are.
It's July 13th. We're in Carmel Valley. We're talking to Susan Brody.
Mm-hmm.
And we always start the tape by simply saying, could you state your name and your birthday?
Uh-huh. My name is Susan McDonald Brody. My birthday is May 28th, 1940.
Mm-hmm. And where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
And did you live in Brooklyn for a long period of time?
I don't remember living in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Where I remember living was in Far Rockaway, New York, which was a beach community. Mm-hmm. And that's where I grew up.
And what did your parents do while you were growing up?
My father was a fireman, New York City Fire Department, and my mother was a housewife. I lived also with my grandparents and in a large extended family near the ocean.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Oh, I had just one brother.
And what did he ever do anything in terms of international work?
He was in the Peace Corps, as was
mm-hmm.
I.
Mm-hmm. And where did you go to college?
I went to Brooklyn College, Brooklyn which College. Is a part of the University of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And to University of California, Berkeley, for graduate study.
And when did you get your BA from Brooklyn?
In American Literature, and then in Library Science from Berkeley.
Mm. My wife got her degree in Library Science from UCLA.
Uh-huh.
And when did you get your BA?
I got my BA in 1958, mm-hmm. I believe.
And how did you become first aware of IBS?
I wasn't aware of IBS. Mm-hmm. I only learned of it through my husband's involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned of it through the War Resisters League
mm-hmm.
when he was a CO in Berkeley at the time.
So after you graduated from Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
You decided to go to library school?
No, after I graduated from Brooklyn College, mm-hmm. I joined the Peace Corps.
Uh-huh.
I was in South America for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and then wanted to go to library school and came out to Berkeley, where I did complete my master's and also met my husband and married.
Mm-hmm. A question, why did you think of going to the Peace Corps after you graduated?
Oh, I was inspired by
mm-hmm.
the rhetoric of the time.
Mm-hmm. The and anything to do with the inauguration speech?
Lot to do with that. A lot to do with Sergeant Shriver,
mm-hmm.
and a lot to do with a real desire to adventure in the world
mm-hmm.
and to be a part of what was happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a major part of my life. To be involved in the events of the time.
Mm-hmm. And you went to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
How did you meet your husband?
I met my husband through mutual friends.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing significant.
Nothing significant.
Nothing doesn't seem very significant anymore.
And let's see, do you remember what year you completed your library degree?
It might have been 1966.
Okay. And when did you meet your husband?
Probably 65.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you get married? Quick, tell me all these
married?
Dates. What year were you married?
65, I think.
Yeah,
yes.
You were married in 65,
uh-huh,
and then
I
you graduated
so.
in
Yeah,
in
I think it was all happening at
mm-hmm.
once at that period.
Now, let's pretend now that
uh-huh.
we're interviewing your husband in this sense that how did he hear about the IBS, and you mentioned through the War Resisters League. Is that through a counseling session or just information he was gathering?
I think it was probably during counseling
mm-hmm.
because when he decided to be a conscientious objector, that was a pretty serious decision at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of counseling going on in Berkeley. And War Resisters League was very much, very prominent in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was early days. Early on, and so I believe that that's how he heard that that was an alternative method of service,
mm-hmm.
and that's how he viewed it.
And did you discuss this about both joining, or?
We assumed that we would both join.
Mm-hmm.
I had my experience in the Peace Corps. I was ready
mm-hmm.
to do that again,
mm-hmm.
And I believe that he, part of his attraction to IVS was to have the kind of experience that I had described to him, and so that we would be more on a par.
Yes, but why Vietnam?
Was Laos, because I think that that's where they were recruiting people for at that time.
Yes, they were.
And I, at the time, attempted to put together in the library school at no less a place than Berkeley a bibliography of current information about Laos. And there was almost nothing. It was astounding. It was a place that nobody knew about.
Did you do this before the IVS?
Before we left, yeah. When we were getting ready to leave, I, as one of my projects for school, attempted a bibliography.
And there are a couple of questions because of this. This is an interesting thing that it was your husband that became initially involved. What was the background to his war resistance experience or convictions?
He claimed at the time that he was influenced by the work of Albert Schweitzer, and that that this was a defining. A defining concept of world peace for him, and that he was an objector to war and would not kill under any circumstances.
And
later on, he became a Quaker, but at the time he wasn't.
He wasn't.
No.
So not a Quaker, but nearly. And so you both wrote to IVS saying you were interested in being volunteers. And did they have Harper's Ferry then?
We didn't go to Harper's Ferry. It was before that. We went to Washington, and we received language instruction there.
Do you remember where? Was it a private kind of school?
I don't remember where.
Yeah. And do you remember, is there anything, as we go along, if you think of it, that you remember about the introduction to Southeast Asia?
Oh, well, there were some State Department types who made speeches. There were the kind of things about what kind of clothes to bring and all the shots and a lot of ignorance, just total ignorance. And then there were the language instructors who were so completely genuine, at least from my perception of them. They were delightful, they were humorous, and they labored hard to try and get us oriented to the language, which seemed so very strange.
Were you, did you know what kind of work you were going to do with Laos at that point?
Well, since I've spoken to you, or since I wrote and answered my questionnaire, I've thought about it long, and I actually really believe that I never was given any work. That that nobody ever told me what I should be doing, and I don't know that I don't know why I never wondered at that. But I don't think I was given a job.
Well, we can find out through IVS records whether there was, but there was a pattern of assigning married couples. IVS did that extensively under certain circumstances. And because of the contract with USAID, which we're going to talk about in a second, about Vietnam and Laos, it became no longer possible to do that, and they started sending single people. But there were some circumstances where married people were preferred because of stability. But we need to research that more. That it's just recently, come up as an issue. But that's something we can...
I think it's very interesting, and I wonder, if I just missed it and never did quite listen to what was said to me, or whether, in fact, I was just his wife, and that's entirely possible.
What was...
He had a job. His job was well digging, was to continue a program of
Was his status as a constructionist or a community development?
Community development.
Community development. There's a statistical thing that Paul just wrote me about that that he wants. And I was just curious as to his religious background and yours up to that point.
Yeah, what?
Up to that point.
Up to that point. Yeah. His religious background was in some of the Protestant... sects? I don't exactly know the language. And I was a Jew. I was brought up as a Jew.
There's, by the way, one famous case of later on, a Jewish IVSer was starting to get too close to being killed and decided it was time to leave. And he went to Israel just in time for the Six-Day War.
Right.
He fought in the Six-Day War.
Huh, did he?
Yes, and in actual fact, was it Chris? No, it was Don Cohen. Had also gone to Israel to seek his roots after he left Vietnam. And ended up filling sandbags, so during the Six-Day War. And I'll never forget that moment because we were doing a simulation of a crisis in the Middle East. And the war broke out during it, and my project director came walking towards me, and he was white as a sheet. And I wanted to say, "We failed again, Ollie," to stop it, like that. But it was the Six-Day War has a kind of imprint the way. Where were you when Kennedy was shot?
Yeah, it does for me too, actually. And I think the person that we succeeded in our village actually was an Israeli who returned to Israel after his service then. And at that point, IBS was international, at least as far as I knew. There were people from many different countries, and I think it still exists.
It's still so. In fact, more so. There are very few actual Americans involved in it. They've gone in a different direction. But that raises an issue. When you were in Washington and everyone was being speechifying, you and your husband probably had to deal some way with the fact that IVS was being contracted by USAID to supply these services. And did you ever think about that consciously or look at it ethically or consider
We didn't look
issue?
At it ethically until later on. And then it became an issue and probably was the issue that brought us to leave. So I think that we were feeling very much the excitement of the adventure, and for Michael, the being able to find a constructive way to use his time as a conscientious objector, and I think we were sort of not paying much attention to those issues at that point.
Yeah, it'll come up later as we go along, but it's amazing how people think, well, you must have thought about that, and they weren't there. That's why they don't realize that people don't make decisions that way. Perceptions are different in different circumstances.
Well, I think we felt that as soon as we left Washington, we would leave all that behind us. And of course, you know, that was part of the allure. One felt like these people weren't to be taken seriously.
And so off you went.
Off we went.
And
to Hong Kong.
Did you buy a tape recorder in Hong Kong?
No, I had no tape recorders, but lots of good food and beer.
Did you know anyone in Hong Kong?
No, but we went as a group, and so we all hung out together in our hotel rooms.
Do you remember who was any people who were in that group?
Oh, yeah, I remember a lot of
those people. Who might they be?
In fact, I think I have a list of the people with whom I was in that, but I haven't got it to hand.
Okay, great. Well, I'll
well, Tom and Tom Russell and Annie Reynolds.
Okay.
Fred Scheidler.
Okay.
Somebody
was
Wolf.
Fred later killed?
Yes, Fred was killed. And that was,
Oh, he was in your group?
Yes, he was in my group.
And
if you mention some names, I might be able to.
What year did you? When did you leave?
I think it was 67.
Spring or?
I think it was spring.
Okay. Spring of 1967, and you didn't go to Harper's Ferry. That's interesting. Maybe. Just later in 67, they started the Harper's Ferry.
And so they trained everyone there after that?
Well, no, the introduction, everyone did do the same thing you did, that is, they went to Washington for language training or whatever, but there was the introductory thing was at Harper's Ferry. And that's something you have to look at, so when did Harper's Ferry start? But see, Don Luce knows all this stuff, so So that's something worth exploring. You flew to Saigon first, and then
yes. uh-huh.
and then to Vientiane,
uh-huh.
and you arrived there. And then, what was your first impression? I mean, Laos was a very special place.
Laos is a very special
yeah.
place. I think first impressions were of obviously the heat and humidity, mm-hmm. and the smallness of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I had been used to traveling in small places, and there was a kind of. There was also the glamour of touching down in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
flying over places mm-hmm. that had been, flying into those airports with all that military stuff going
okay,
on.
Okay, that's a good place.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when you flew into Saigon, actually, did you experience the spiral descent into Saigon,
mm-hmm.
a very tight or steep descent?
Definitely.
Because of, yeah,
definitely, okay. yeah. And just the volume of what was happening there, mm-hmm. even seen from the... And I went through Saigon quite a few times en
mm-hmm.
route to other places. And the incredible green, the incredible green of that place, and then the vast machine of the war there, the volume of people, of planes, of equipment, of barbed wire, of everything, was just awesome. In contrast, Vientiane was this little dusty place where the plane flew in and you walked down the stairs and went through very perfunctory customs and you're in. And sponsored by the US government, I don't even know if they ever opened our bags. So it was kind of a strange arrival, or a study in contrasts. And Vientiane and Vietnam and Laos rather always remained that sort of dusty, sleepy place as far as my experience of it was
mm-hmm.
concerned, where my encounters were mostly on an interpersonal level rather
mm-hmm.
than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, after you arrived, where did you go? Was there a
I think we went. We may have gone to the ambassador's house.
Mm.
I don't remember the exact details. I more remember the jeep ride out to our village.
Mm-hmm.
There probably was some kind of reception, and it may have been at the ambassador's house.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of walled communities there, American enclaves.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been in one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that very well.
Mm-hmm. And what was the village that you were assigned to?
The village is called Bang Khun.
Oh, could you spell it for the...
Bangkeun. And it was just slightly north of Vientiane, across the Mekong. And we got there by jeep and ferry over fairly good roads,
mm-hmm.
actually.
How long did it take to get there?
Maybe an hour, maybe
mm-hmm.
an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
My memory says 40 kilometers, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's true.
Well, Laos, 40 kilometers.
It was all like
all
this,
place,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And were you and your husband
mm-hmm.
were assigned to that village. Was there anyone else there?
There were a couple of other people there.
Mm-hmm.
There was Chaim Levitt, who
mm-hmm.
was the Israeli volunteer I told
mm-hmm.
you that,
mm-hmm.
and Tom Dutton, who was the USAID person. And we actually all shared a house that was considerably larger than Lao houses and was not on stilts. It was built to the ground. And we all lived there together for periods. And then both Tom and Chaim left different times.
Mm-hmm. And were they replaced by other people, did you?
No, they weren't.
You,
no,
just
we
all by yourself.
Then we ended up being by ourselves.
Were you ever issued a radio?
We had a radio
mm-hmm.
from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And was there an airstrip?
There was an airstrip.
There when you got there.
There was an airstrip
mm-hmm.
when we
okay.
got there. And we made frequent use of that,
mm-hmm.
of the radio to call in airplanes
mm-hmm.
and to leave that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in and out.
In and out. And, well, how did you set up house? What was your... How did you find what you were going to do, which is an interesting thing.
Right. Well, we were issued furniture and all of that stuff. Right. So that was all pretty simple. There was a little market in the town, a morning market, and food was available that way. And
you lived off the local?
Yeah.
Well, that's unusual.
Yeah. We did. Yeah. We had access to the commissary. And so toilet articles, things like that, were, you know, we could get. But, yeah, we lived off the out in the market.
That's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Because mostly the in Laos there was a concern that any kind of American funding in a relatively small place would overburden the economy. And for that reason, they flew stuff in or delivered it directly from the commissary.
The only time we ever had food flown in was when there was a flood and there was no market and we had no food.
So you were there for the Great Flood of 1967.
Yes, please go on. So basically, just in relation to the environment, it was fairly small town, but larger than all the satellite towns. There were other towns around in this area, and with the Mekong River right there. The Nam Nung, it was Namnung River, which later I think was dammed by the Japanese. I believe there was a dam built on that tributary of the Mekong. The people grew upland rice, sticky rice, and the local mayor was French speaking, fairly young, fairly educated. Mm. There was definitely an in-place bureaucracy and hierarchy. There was a small commissary hospital with a French-speaking medic and French-speaking midwife. Both of them had been trained by the French. I don't know if it was they were trained in Laos or in Vietnam or somewhere else. If I knew that, I don't remember any longer. And we eventually employed a Lao woman to come in and help keep house and cook. And she was a really good friend of mine. We were very close. I was also very close to the daughter of the mayor, who was another very close friend. And so with those other young women, and I was pretty young at the time, we sort of had a little community of interest. So the work that Michael was to do, the well drilling, was already in progress, and well digging. And this entailed digging, the villagers being organized to want to take on the work of digging this big hole in the ground. And then these concrete well rings were sunk in place and stacked, and the water table was such that the water just came in. There was no pump, no way of it was simply allowed, water was just simply allowed to rise in these wells. And then I think that there was a cement slab poured around the rim, an apron around the rim of the well. And the idea being, I guess, that people needed to have access to water that wasn't used to bathe buffaloes or wash clothes, and that it was a more sanitary environment, more sanitary water. At the time, I was very naive about those things, and I didn't really know much about it at all. And I suppose that those wells were useful in those villages. People certainly used them, but they also continued to use the water from the river as well. I don't know if it was an entirely useful operation or not. Hard to gauge. We were only there a year, so you know, my perspective is very short. And I ended up spending a lot of time just talking to people. I believe if I was given any instruction, it was to, or any direction, it was to help teach women about domestic affairs, some kind of community development among women.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, their culture was so so different than my understanding that I would have had to have been there many more years than I was to have been able to offer anything of substance or use for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up spending a lot of time at the medical clinic, and eventually ended up driving the Jeep around and taking the medic and or the midwife to places where people needed them.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I think that if I served any function, that was as chauffeur to the midwife.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a lot of births. I assisted at a lot of births, and I, in emergency, would call in medical evacuation.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot of deaths, and became very interested in midwifery and in the work that was being done there, and saw a lot of very, very strange things. And I think the only reason why I, at the time, I accepted them all as I just didn't know any better. I simply didn't know anything about anything. So it was all okay. And that was probably the best place to be in.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any? I mean, do you reflect back now and think about? Just for the record, now that you know a little more
about some things,
what was one of those things that you didn't know about and it was probably just as well?
Well, there was a practice there was a practice in birthing a child to apply pressure on the top of a woman's abdomen to hasten the birth, and there would be three or four really strong hands just pushing down on the woman's abdomen to hasten the birth. And I know that couldn't have been a really safe practice
mm-hmm.
or appropriate use of force.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of yanking of babies into life, and I saw a lot of babies not surviving.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of thing. Basically, I think, though, that the birthing practices were in relation to our practices, they were very same. Men and women, men did not enter the birthing room. They were right outside. People would congregate. The whole community would congregate when a woman was in labor.
Mm-hmm.
And the midwife and maybe the woman's mother or a close friend or maybe several would be in the room with her, and she would hold a rope tied to the rafters
mm-hmm.
And squat and deliver in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, from my understanding since, a really appropriate
mm-hmm.
use of the body to help hasten the birth. But the pushing and the pulling obviously were totally inappropriate.
An amazing mixture.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a very famous carving in the life of the Buddha of Queen Maya holding a branch
mm-hmm.
and giving birth to the Buddha standing up. So this is a normal practice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And now we have birthing chairs.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Or the squat.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also the at the same time that the midwife would be there, the animist spirit shaman would be
mm-hmm.
there, and especially if there was trouble in the birth,
mm-hmm.
and that would be the one man that would be allowed and
mm-hmm.
would be present. And he had seemed to his entire practice seemed to be to fill his mouth with water and squirt it and spray it all over whoever was suffering and in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was always those two things happening at once in critical moments. And I was deeply moved by that
mm-hmm.
experience, about all of it. I felt really very bonded to the people I knew there,
mm-hmm.
deeply bonded. unqualified affection and just empathy.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the sacred to the profane.
Mm-hmm.
What were your relations with USAID in the village?
Well, during the time that Tom Dutton was there, mm-hmm. we had really a very close relationship. Mm-hmm. We shared meals, we shared our days together, mm-hmm. We went to village celebrations together, we all got drunk together. Mm-hmm. Part of the village celebration was the insistence that you drink as much lao lao as you could hold.
Mm-hmm.
And
was it any good?
It was horrible.
That's horrible.
And as a woman, I was allowed to just throw it over my shoulder.
Uh-huh.
I would take it and right. sip it, and then I could dump it. But the men had to drink it.
Uh-huh.
And there were just nights when everybody would be hanging out the windows, just throwing up. Just so sick. That was horrid. And mixed with very, very spicy food, and
mm-hmm.
you know, just dancing until you dropped. And it was a lot of partying. And
the description of a bossy.
Uh-huh, yeah. Bossy, right. And so we shared our lives together with Tom, and it was really
But he wasn't, when Tom was there, it wasn't obtrusive.
Yeah, I think that I really don't even know what he did. He talked mm-hmm. on the radio and ordered supplies. He got well rings. He facilitated whatever work it was we were doing,
mm-hmm.
if we were doing any work.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point he left, and I don't remember the particulars of his leaving, although it wasn't abrupt, and you know, we had a celebration to see him off.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a picture of him over there,
mm-hmm.
by the way. And then we were alone, and we didn't have any CIA.
That was a good
yeah,
Freudian
slip.
That
was a good one.
We'll get back to that in
uh-huh.
a minute, but go ahead. Yeah,
we had some of that,
uh-huh.
but we didn't have any USAID people.
Uh-huh.
And we would, from time to time, talk to people in Vientiane, and they all seemed so out of it and ineffectual. I don't know what they were doing, and I suspect they weren't doing much.
You mean the obvious people you spoke to?
The
administrator?
USAID.
Oh, the USAID
yeah,
folk.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was USAID.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so the USAID folk you met in Vientiane didn't look like they were doing anything.
They didn't seem to be.
Uh-huh.
They seemed to be really... if they were doing anything, they didn't really care what we were doing, at
mm-hmm.
least... us
mm-hmm.
in particular,
mm-hmm.
we weren't important, and we were in an area that was very secure,
mm-hmm.
and so as long as we didn't make any trouble and there was no trouble, I don't think anybody really paid much attention
mm-hmm.
to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the impression I had.
I think Fred Branfman went off to a village not far out of town. Just said, just let me. I won't make any trouble. I'll just do my thing in this village. Just leave me alone. And they left him alone. But
mm-hmm.
of course, that was IBS. That had nothing to do with
yeah.
USAID directly.
Yeah, nobody mm-hmm. really seemed to pay us much mind.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, I wonder at that. I just,
mm-hmm.
it's very strange.
Mm-hmm.
It's really very strange.
And while you were driving around the
mm-hmm.
midwife team, your husband was going out into neighboring villages, you
right,
create
doing
a kind
the,
of pattern and
right, doing the well
digging the wells,
stuff.
Uh-huh,
yeah, uh-huh.
Did
yeah.
he find that satisfying? Did he?
I think he found it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he found the work with people to be interesting. He liked the people
mm-hmm.
a lot. We both did, and I don't know if he found it satisfying.
Oh no, ask him actually.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered whether there
yeah.
was an atmosphere of ennui or atmosphere of ineffectualness.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether you felt that...
I think that he felt that he was doing something at least useful.
Mm-hmm. And the cement and stuff?
Came from...
Was it flown in or brought by truck?
My guess is it was flown in.
Flown in, mm-hmm.
But it would have been wiser to bring it by truck. But my
mm-hmm.
guess is it was flown in because we were right en route. And there were, yes, it was phone in, because now I remember there were these big cargo planes used to fly in and bring stuff. We were right en route, the main air route from Vientiane to the north of the country.
Did you ever, in that year, did you ever visit other places?
I visited Luang Prabang, and I visited that's the only place I visited, was Luang Prabang.
Any reflections on? It was beautiful. You liked the temples.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was beautiful being up in the mountains. I the Vientiane and Lang Kun are down in the flats on the plain, and it was wonderful being up in the mountains. It was so different. So the culture was different. One of the things that was very interesting about my town is that there were a lot of Hmong people in close by used to come into town to trade, and they would come in large groups of people to trade and then leave again. So we were an area where we didn't have many tribes people, but we did have some. And when I went to Luang Prabang just to see so many different other ethnic groups was pretty interesting. But I was there very briefly.
Did you ever have a chance to buy any Hmong crafts?
I have a lot. I have a small collection of fine fabrics, actually, still. Mostly silks, and I'd be happy to show you.
Oh, great. The Galen Beery was saying that it seemed to him that there are colors appearing in Hmong crafts that, of course, must be synthetic. And
right, well, that was an issue when I was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, for me it was an issue because I got involved with a weaving project, and we were talking about the very, very synthetic dyes were just beginning to be imported from Europe and used. All the villages wove, all of the villages wove, the women in the area I was in, and I think throughout Laos, generally speaking. Every house had a loom down below the upper part where people lived. And so the advent of the synthetic dyes became an issue in the area where I lived. Yeah, I'm just making noises here, turning pages, and showing you the layout of how a house, the loom was located down below, and the living quarters above. And that down below was also where pigs and chickens and other animals were fed and kept.
These children over here in this picture are in this little dress.
Generally speaking, I think that the children, that's unusual, but I guess those things came in from Europe.
Well, my favorite experience was meeting the pygmy on his little coffee farm. And he was wearing an Apollo 13 mission. No, it wasn't 13, and it was much earlier than that, but it was like Apollo 9 Mission Control. It was a Chinese made knockoff. And just, I have a picture of him, and there's nothing incongruous about it, but our image of darkest Africa is so distorted.
Absolutely.
And the reality is that they live lives so similar.
Exactly.
And the clothing, the materials, where they come from, they're international. They're
That's
not,
right.
You know, people don't wear loincloths anymore.
No, they don't.
So, and of course, that was a long time ago.
He's my husband, and he started a little kiln in our backyard, and he was making pottery. We had a beautiful rosewood potter's wheel, and this is the view out of our house. This is during the flood, and this was the mayor's house, actually. This is the house we lived in. Once again. So I wasn't a feminist at the time, but I got very involved in the life of the women of the village, and just mostly as an observer. I just like to hang out in their houses and hang out and talk to them. And just
these
enjoyed
are, these
hanging
are rather,
out.
These are rather wonderful ethnographic photographs.
Uh-huh, they are pretty great.
This is something, what kind of camera?
It was some camera that IVS issued.
Really?
And also paid for the film to be developed.
Uh-huh. They did do that.
Yeah, they did.
But I'm just surprised at the uniform exposure quality.
Yeah, it's very nice, isn't it?
Very amazing. Quick,
you're
put this
welcome.
Back in the safe.
Okay, you're welcome to use this if you would like any of that material.
Well, we'll arrange something that if there is something like a Federal Express pickup,
mm-hmm.
What we can do sometime is when our ship comes in, I'll send you a check,
mm-hmm.
and so you can send it to me, Federal Express, and I'll scan it into a computer, and then just return Federal Express it to you.
Okay.
Because I don't want to carry it with me because if my car
was
broken into.
Oh, no, I don't want you to carry it with
you. I would never want to do that. And
no.
And this way it's...
Good.
It's just door to door, so to speak, and there's no slippage.
Good.
And
well,
that's the best way of doing that.
Fine.
I've told a couple of people, Gary Studebaker, did you?
I don't think
ever
I
hear of
him.
Gary? Gary had some nice pictures of different ones than these.
Mm-hmm.
And those are exceptional photographs in many ways. I mean, I thought I was looking at the Nagas of Manipur or something. That I mean, that's the way it looked, in the sense that the composition,
uh-huh.
and the subject and the lighting and everything is awfully good. Whoever took those should be congratulated, whoever they were. You spent a year there,
uh-huh.
and went through that horrendous flood of...
Right.
Were you evacuated out of there during the...
No,
the
flood? They asked if we wanted to be evacuated,
mm-hmm.
but really one of the villages loaned us a little canoe,
mm-hmm.
and so we canoed from our first story,
mm-hmm.
out to high ground, and,
mm-hmm.
and we lived on the second story, so there was no problem.
Mm-hmm.
We had snakes hanging, swimming down in the first story,
mm-hmm.
and it was just an adventure. We
mm-hmm.
just hung out and enjoyed it.
How did you get food?
Well, that's when they did. They did send us spam and some other unmentionable.
Famous story in our family. Yeah. Don't laugh at spam. It has its uses.
Well, right.
Yeah.
So canned,
right.
you know,
uh-huh.
canned chip chicken and spam.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
We just was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And we just stayed there.
It's amazing. So,
yeah.
Well, this went on for a year.
This went on for a year.
And you saw many births. And
we saw many births.
Mm-hmm.
We traveled to different villages.
Mm-hmm.
We ate native food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lao food, which is an incredible cuisine,
mm.
really wonderful. Many births. We nursed a child who had meningitis and who died. Michael and I stayed up. We just became active in the
mm-hmm.
community.
Mm-hmm.
We went to deaths. We were part of village deaths and cremations. And holidays and firecracker festivals.
And mostly just the two of you.
Just the two of us.
And you didn't leave very often?
No, we didn't leave.
Yeah.
We left. We did go to Bangkok for one R&R, and we
mm-hmm.
went to Hong Kong
mm-hmm.
once, mostly again just to eat, because
mm-hmm.
we were fanatical Chinese food enthusiasts. We were. We just tried to get through our days eating as many meals as possible. It was great. No, we didn't leave much.
Mm-hmm.
We were there most of the time.
But you only stayed a year.
Right. We only stayed a year, and that was because of Fred Scheidler's death.
Mm-hmm.
Fred was killed, was assassinated,
mm-hmm.
and...
Could you describe that, just for the tape, describe the circumstances?
As I remember, my understanding of the circumstances is he was shot while he was asleep. In his house, he was shot by someone coming underneath the house and and spraying it with bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we started to examine our ethical position, that we were a part of the American war effort because we were we represented the United States, and we were being paid by the United States. And that what we were doing was not without, it had implications that we really hadn't been.
Well, how did Fred's death raise those implications?
Well, it did, because he was a friend,
mm-hmm.
because we felt it deeply, and because we realized that we just by being there represented the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the United States to us, the major reason that we were there was as an American presence in relation to the Pathet Lao, in relation to the war in Vietnam and the larger war throughout Southeast Asia.
And what did you think that presence was supposed to do?
Well, I think that we felt that presence was supposed to make friends for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we were very effective in making friends mm-hmm. for the United States.
Was it wrong to make friends for the United States?
Well, I think at the time we thought it was.
Uh-huh. And what I'm trying, all these are just probing uh-huh. questions to try to get you to say all sorts of interesting things. But the issue is that you were there to make friends for the United States. That was okay. But in the context, are you suggesting that because there was a war going on, making friends for the United States had a political content?
Yeah, well,
it.
I take that for granted. I mean, I'm sorry, assuming
people
that.
People who
yeah,
listen to the tape
right,
don't really understand all those complexities.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was all in the context of the political situation
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we were, by our presence there, acting as political instruments for
mm-hmm.
the United States. And that was not... that wasn't consistent with the conscientious objective status, and it wasn't consistent with our personal political feelings about the war. At that point, the Ho Chi Minh Trail became prominent. The bombings became much more intense, and our opposition to the war became much more acute. We felt that we were a part of the war. And
there was a war in Laos? How did you know?
How did I
Who
guess?
Told you? Who told you
yeah.
there was a war in Laos? Was it the fellows with the wraparound sunglasses?
We were there yeah. were guys with guns everywhere.
Uh-huh.
As I would drive my Jeep around the villages, there would be guys with guns hitching a ride. I would have, you know, these boy soldiers
mm-hmm.
hanging off the Jeep with
of the Royal Army.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
with their big, whatever kind of guns they were slung
mm-hmm.
over their shoulders. And it was so, it was like gun safety was not an issue. These things were just pointed helter-skelter. But there were children with guns,
mm-hmm.
and they were everywhere. And there were so-called... I forget the euphemism for these military attachés who would suddenly turn up in our village, or would be flown in and walk around and talk to the mayor and then be flown out. And it just started to heat up. It started to heat up right about then.
You're referring to Americans who came in into the...
Yeah, Americans. And, yeah, Americans.
Did any of them ever talk to you?
We had this one absolutely hysterical in thing where this... riverboat came up river, and the British ambassador, the American military attaché, a couple of other people were on this boat, bunch of embassy staff, and they came, and we picnicked out of the commissary of the British ambassador. They came for a Basi celebration, and they stayed the night, I believe. They stayed on their boat on the river, but they ate with us, and the British ambassador was an incredibly urbane, wonderful man who later wrote a book on Lao cooking, which I have looked for ever since and never encountered.
Mm.
And he was a marvelous person. So if you find the book, you gotta
Laos
let me know.
Laos Cooking by a former British ambassador to Laos.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I think I can. I'm sure Galen knows who that
I'm
was.
I'm sure Galen definitely knows. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was quite an event. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never spoke to any of them except on that occasion mm-hmm. when they were my guests.
Yes, because one of the was suggested, you know, that IBSers could unwittingly or reluctantly be a conduit for intelligence information.
Mm-hmm.
In Laos.
Nobody ever asked us. I think we were total innocents.
Mm-hmm.
And we never really encountered any political activity in our stay in that area except mm-hmm. for one village where we were obviously not welcome,
mm-hmm.
where I think there was more Pathet Lao sentiment and we were really not welcome, and
mm-hmm.
so we really just didn't go.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone ever, while you were in the village, did anyone ever suggest, for example, that it wouldn't be a good idea to go to a certain place?
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this particular one place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And getting back to Fred's death,
mm-hmm.
The problem is that several IBSers then went on, like Galen, went on to work for USAID, and they have, I'm not referring to Galen actually
mm-hmm.
in this case at all, referring here to Galen Beery, who was one of the earlier groups in Laos and stayed on with USAID for I think almost 14 years total in Laos. But he didn't suggest this, but that Fred, for example, and other IBSers that found themselves in trouble in Laos were jeopardized themselves by not reading the tea leaves, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
not accepting warnings, not acknowledging that the Pathet Lao had to live up to its orders.
Mm-hmm.
And if they said, "We don't want you here," you had to leave. Because then they'd have to kill you if you didn't go away.
Exactly.
And what were your feelings about that?
I don't recall that being the subject of our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's entirely plausible that Fred would have resisted. Would have resisted believing that anyone
mm-hmm.
could harm him.
Mm-hmm.
Or that he was that if he were doing good that he could be in danger.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely consistent with the person I knew.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there were many IBSers in Laos who felt that way?
I think it's very possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really is that they were motivated by good and
mm-hmm.
thereby and therefore good only good could come.
Mm-hmm.
My husband, Michael, tried to organize a mass exodus of IVSs from Laos at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't taken seriously by anybody. And then, in the same kind of way, we had to leave in order to back up the rhetoric that
mm-hmm.
that we had, that we
well,
had
intended. Well, when did you leave?
Well, I'm not exactly sure.
Uh-huh.
I think it was the spring the following year. Then.
Spring of 1968?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because of the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, there was a lot of soul searching, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, did you know Fred Branfman in Vinchon?
I did know, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you, well, actually what I'm asking is, how did you communicate these concerns?
We
did
went
you go
in,
to a
there
meeting?
Was a meeting.
That's right.
Yeah, there was
this is,
a meeting.
This is, I think, August of 19... It couldn't have been August then.
No, it couldn't have been August.
No.
It had to have been towards the top of the year.
Yeah.
The end of the year.
The end of the year, maybe November,
mm-hmm.
November of 67?
Perhaps.
Yeah. And there was a big meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred remembers this meeting as if it was yesterday. I don't mean that facetiously. That is, he wrote a letter to Don Luce when
uh-huh.
he heard about this project. He said, if this is going to be a whitewash, I don't want to be involved in it because, I had this thing with Art Gardner and,
uh-huh.
and Fred Schindler's death and all these other things. And I was at a meeting and I said, we have to pull out unless we include the Pathet Lao in our meetings.
Hmm.
Do you remember that at all?
No, I don't remember that part.
Yeah, he said that there was a conference about development or something. And he suggested that the Path of Lao be invited because that would show that IVS
was neutral.
And an IVS leader flew out and told them that there would be no Path of Lao. And Fred said, look around the room,
mm-hmm.
because some of these people are going to die. And he had them look at, actually Art was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He said, some of these people are going to die because the way this thing is going in Laos, people are not going to be able to differentiate between us and USAID or any other government thing. And he felt sadly vindicated by the fact that Art was later killed. And but do you remember any
I remember that meeting.
Uh-huh.
I remember that meeting. I remember certainly the emotional the emotional freight of that meeting.
Mm-hmm. And as Fred said something like it was a close vote, that he wanted a vote of the IVSers in support of inviting the Path at Lao. Do you remember that at all?
No, I certainly don't.
Okay. That's all right. I'm not doubting that it occurred. It's
I'm sure it occurred.
We'll keep poking around until Galen, on the night of that meeting, wrote that memo that I referred to before. And actually had tremendous sympathy, of course, having been an IVSer himself. And, and he was asking, you know, well, everyone considered Fred to be a kind of outlaw, you know, but he was not, he felt that he was making a point. The issue, though, was, and this is, I'm sure you'll more closely remember, should IVS remain in Vietnam, given the circumstances, Laos, given the circumstances of Fred's death. And you and your husband were in a position of saying, no, we should leave.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we should leave for ethical reasons,
mm-hmm.
for a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it was clearly that we were on the side of
mm-hmm.
of the Americans. It was not, we felt, I think that in this was something that Michael felt more strongly than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very sad to leave the village and to leave Laos. I didn't want to do that, but we did it. And as far as Fred having been an outlaw, you know, it's really interesting.
No, I don't mean that. I just meant a unique individual with very strong opinions.
It was there was a certain, in our group, we who knew him in a different way, you know, we knew him from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
there was a sort of feeling that there was an angel.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very particular kind of charm.
Mm-hmm. And still does.
Yes.
He really does.
Yeah.
He's very unique. And
yeah.
In fact, what was interesting is that he was interviewed for Roger Warner's book. It's called Backfire. It's
mm-hmm.
about the CIA running the war in Laos, running the USAID, running the whole operation.
Well, what's the name of that book?
Oh, I'll write it down for you. It's called The Backfire.
Uh-huh.
It's by Roger Warner. And it's in all good bookstores.
Uh-huh.
It's too darn
expensive. So when was it written?
It's either this year or 95, but I'm pretty sure it's this year.
Okay.
Yeah, it is this year, because it's still in hardback.
Uh-huh.
And I'd wait.
No, well, I'm a library user.
Exactly. So you can get it on interlibrary loan.
Right.
And a lot of it's about Fred. I mean, Fred takes up maybe, book might be 200 pages, and Fred's about 30 of them. And
Fred Scheidler?
No.
Fred
Brampton.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's kind of a biography of Fred Brampton
mm-hmm.
in it. And but what was it? I wanted to say something about...
I mentioned angels.
Yes, an angel. Yes, why an angel?
Well, I think there was an innocence
mm-hmm.
that was beyond any of the... I mean, obviously, in recounting all this, I see how innocent we all were.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also another dimension of innocence
mm-hmm.
in there that was really, that we all recognized.
Well, the reason I mention that is that I was saying that Fred, in the book, in
uh-huh.
Roger Warner's book, now I've remembered, says that, you know, he'd be perfectly happy to sit down with all those USAID and CIA folk now, that he doesn't bear any grudges,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's of the past. And I was talking to Howard Lewin. I don't know if you ever met Howard. He went out with, he was, I think, with USAID by the time
mm-hmm.
he came in. And he stayed there as long as Galen did. And he was an engineer. I mean, he was a born engineer. All
mm-hmm.
he wanted to build roads, do the things that really matter. Forget the pig projects, forget
mm-hmm.
the windmills, forget the wells. if we can just build a road from this village to that village, everything's going to change because I'll have access to markets, transportation. And he was extremely stubborn and single-minded, he felt, you know, during his service. And he could be a real pain in the posterior. And, you know, he hated Fred with a passion in those days because he was, that's what I meant by troublemaker from their perspective, you know. And yet he, you know, although he's not, it's like a, Westmoreland is never going to hug Jane Fonda. You know, that's not going to happen. But, you know, even he is softened, you know, so considerably with time and with maturity because everyone was young.
We were all very young. Yes. And we were all, we were all had no idea of the scale of what was happening and this, and how really what we were doing was just was a sort of a side drama and was such a big drama to us, but the rest of it was so much bigger.
Were you, do you know what a forward action team was? And were you aware of how much the U.S. military, and well, not the U.S. military, but in fact, they, well, anyway, the CIA was operating in Laos. What was your
My
take
contact
on that?
Was, I knew it because of the flights and the guys who were flying and when we would talk to those pilots, they would tell us what was happening up in the mountains and up north.
What did they tell you was happening?
Well, they would talk about, I do remember about the forward forward action teams. And they would talk about moving people in and they would just there was, there was a kind of air of an ongoing bigger thing happening beyond our small village. But we were really isolated from that in so many ways.
Did you know who Pop Buell was?
Yeah.
What did you think of Pop Buell, what Pop was doing?
Well, I think that we tended to be a little cynical about Pop Buell and the whole the whole scene around him. I don't think that we believed that he was genuine. I don't know if he was.
Galen thought so. Ultimately.
That he was genuine.
He said he didn't believe anything about it until he saw Pop with three children. He delivered them all. And then he realized that it wasn't a myth. You know, that he was...
That he was genuine.